very glad to have this week our colleague Manu Sokti, who's an associate professor of architecture at the UW Milwaukee. And he was here last year. I didn't have a chance to interact with him, but one of my students took a class he was teaching on Islamic architecture, but we have met previously at the UW Milwaukee. And I'd like to say in advance that that Manu and I will be going out to the terrace after the talk, so if anybody would like to join us and engage in some conversation for an hour, we'd be happy if you joined us. So Dr. Manu Sokti is a specialist in Islamic architecture and urban history. He's an associate professor in the School of Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. His ongoing research focuses on the urban history of early medieval Islamic cities along the Silk Road and in the Indian subcontinent, with particular reference to the complex borderland geographies created by riverine landscapes. And so his work is really kind of comparative and transdisciplinary, thinking about like the Mississippi, the Danube, Ganges, and Amudarya. And he's currently completing a manuscript entitled The Sliver of the Oxus Borderland, Medieval Cultural Encounters Between the Arabs and the Persians. And he's received a wide range of awards, many of whom are unfamiliar to people like me, because they tend to be for these wonderful things like Aga Khan fellowships and so on for people who do art and architecture. But he has a whole string of them, and most recently, he had a transdisciplinary research collaborative award from the Center for 21st Century Studies at the UW Milwaukee, and he was, as I said, a visitor here. I mentioned that. But at any rate, so please join me in welcoming Professor Manu Sokti, who will be talking about medieval river logs, crossing, and contestations along the Oxus borderland.
Thank you, Ulay. And I think I can reduce these lights. Lights come out really nice.
You figured it out faster than we usually do.
Yeah, but I came here 10 minutes in advance because I depend on these guys and I spend time putting them together. So, a pleasure to be here today. And in fact, I've been here, last year I was here at the IRH and I was teaching this class. And I found a wonderful audience for some of my discussions on Islamic architecture, and this class was actually simulcast back to Milwaukee, which is kind of strange that it should be simulcast from here back to Milwaukee. But anyway, we had a good set of students. We had about 12 students or so from Madison and about 6 from Milwaukee, so we had a good group of students. Now, what I'm going to present to you today is something that I've been working on for some time. About 2 years now, and I have a host of doctoral students who are working with me. I have now about, counting the students who will come in fall, I have about 8 doctoral students who are working on topics related to urbanism, in particular to urbanism in the Islamic world. And some of them, about half of them, are working on medieval and early medieval urbanism. I know some of you would have a question. Well, what does medieval actually mean to the world of Islam? Well, we'll let that question rest for some time, because that's not the point of this particular presentation. I can clarify that later, if at all I don't exhaust you with my talk and with my pictures. I need to get to what I'm talking about here. I've been to Uzbekistan and to Central Asia several times, in fact, too many times. And at the drop of a hat, I go to Uzbekistan, which is where my affinities, my passion lies. In fact, my daughter's name is Zarfashan. And in fact, people in Uzbekistan are quite stunned when I tell them that we znaite moi dochiri evo zavut da Zarfashan. And this is because of my love for that place. Of course, long story short, I was actually writing my PhD dissertation at the time when she came. And I had all sorts of names for her, all of them from Central Asia, but Zarfashan was the one that I found the most beautiful. And of course, it has wonderful connotations. At that time, which was several years ago, I did not realize that Zarfashan would become important to me, because it was actually a tributary of the river Oxus, the Amudarya in Central Asia. And it seems I went to Uzbekistan so many times, but I did not realize. I was, of course, obsessed in looking at the architecture, at the culture, at cities, but I did not realize that I was not looking at something that was, in fact, absolutely connected to the ethos of that particular place, which was landscape and geography. And in fact, I discovered only late one day in conversation with my favorite driver, Shafior, who would always take me around Oli Makkah, who I call up from here, and he always connects with me while I'm there, and he takes me around all the time I'm there from one city to the other. I said, Oli Makkah, where is the Oxus River? He says, I've never seen it. I've only driven on a highway that goes by it. It's behind the mountains. And so I said, let's drive on this highway and see the river. Let's try to see it wherever we can. He says, but you can't go there. We are not supposed to go there. It's no man's land. It is borderland territory. So I began to get interested. And I realized that this interest in early medieval cities in Central Asia was actually connected to the river, because the Arab armies that had crossed the river at the time of the Arab invasions crossed this particular river in ways to actually allow certain cities to develop at a distance from the river, which I will talk about in this presentation. I also realized, when I scratched the surface a little bit more, that this river was even more important because only a few points along its length had remained the crossing points. And in fact, this was the case through the course of its history. Not that this river was not passable at other points, but for some strange reason, all the caravan routes, even today and even in the past, had actually gone on these very crossing points. So I decided to study the river, the potomology of the river, as a river historian would call. Potomology is an old-fashioned word. It used to be employed when one studied the Colorado River or the Mississippi River. Now it's old-fashioned. But if you were a river historian, you would understand it's all about the way the river works. But it's more about geography. It's more about the quantitative aspects of the river. I wanted to somehow stitch the quantitative with the qualitative, which was because for me, the river was almost like a palimpsest, which was trying to talk about what it really was. Now, the most important thing that I encountered was that lots of people had crossed the river in time, and I was interested in the medieval period, in the early medieval period, when the Arab armies crossed the river. But what remained behind was almost nothing, because this river had been a site of abandonment. So I decided to look at the records that in some ways documented the way in which this river had seen, witnessed history. So I keep saying that my work in some ways gives voice to the river. It gives voice to a landscape that cannot speak for itself. And that's something that architects don't normally do. They do not give voice to the building. They become the voice for it. But here I'm actually trying to give voice to the landscape. And it's been a journey for me, because I am essentially trained as an architect and then became interested in history, in linguistics and culture, and then found my way trying to unravel the way in which these could be explained. But then I brought in my skills in combining this information together visually. In fact, the most exciting part of what is happening to the story is unraveling right now. I'm actually preparing a PBS preview, teaser, on the river for funding in the next 1 month. If you have the time, I will show you the beginning of that. It's not completely finished, but I have some people working on it, and we are trying to combine historical evidence and text and animation and maps and digital renderings to explain what this river is and how important it is in the course of history. So I have to confess I have a prepared paper, because I think I want to say a few things in particular ways, and I will read this paper out. And while this paper happens, there will be images that will, I will click them, and I will also animate them. So at some point, you will have to take over from me and listen to my voice in the background and look at the images in the foreground. Okay. And I need a little extra light, because my... So it's wonderful to be amongst you all today with the opportunity to present at UW's Center for Russian, East European, and Central Asian Studies. In multiple ways, this is an important moment for me, and especially allowed me to bring together two diverse aspects of my ongoing work. The first via my formal training as an architect, and the second, given my passionate preoccupation as a humanist, intensely interested in asking enduring questions on riverine borderlands and their interrelated histories. David Christen's Maps of Time, An Introduction to Big History, unites the fields of natural history and human history in a single intelligible narrative. In its superlative attempts to create an overarching umbrella of knowledge, it is perhaps analogous to Isaac Newton's universal laws of motion that it accommodated the idiosyncratic movement of the heavens relative to Earth, or perhaps to Darwin's now controversial examination of life forms within the arc of a single evolutionary process. It is precisely via the exemplar of interwoven small, medium, large, and extra-large scales, which I call simply as SMLXL, posited alongside the structure of the Brodelian long degree, tacitly inherent in Christen's work, that I interrogate the hows and the whys of contested ecologies such as the Oxus borderland. How do these space-time conditions get engaged to larger scenarios beyond their own seeming micro-events? I also look at Clifford Geertz, the so-called purveyor of small things, who in his thick descriptions of cultures and societies sets up a methodology to draw a phenomenon in sufficient detail, allowing translation and transfer to other times, settings, situations, and people. Finally, in capacity as a map maker, cartographer at large, more figuratively and in borrowing liberally from Gilbert Ryle, my work is intended not merely to increase what we know about places, but to rectify the logical geographies of the knowledge that we already possess about these places. Contested ecologies and borderlands created by these contentious space-time configurations come under the purview of Bruno Latour, calls hybrid systems, wherein biophysical environments, politics, policies, technologies, values, meanings, histories are thoroughly entangled and intertwined. In other words, these hybrid systems facilitate no easy readings, nor provide direct answers. While these readings have only seemed relevant now, their status quo was challenged through the course of human history. It is on these lines that I seek fresh ways to combine different expertise on globally removed regions via new modes of transdisciplinary research, and in this process, design the possibilities of encounter between system modeling approaches in the physical sciences alongside qualitative hermeneutic approaches inherent to the humanities and the humanistic social sciences. In my humble expertise as an architect, not so much as a practitioner, but rather as a figurative cartographer, as I've already mentioned, I discard the architect's frequently exaggerated role as a problem solver of past generations. Instead, I view architecture and urban studies as the vantage to re-explore and redefine seminal questions of what constitutes place, space, and culture. The rapidly globalizing world has compelled my field to address complex issues that require a qualitative, not just quantitative, shift. It is within this broad context of research that I present and extract from my forthcoming book with Brill Press entitled The Sliver of the Oxus Borderland, Medieval Cultural Encounters Between the Arabs and Persians. Positioned within the context of the Arab invasions of Central Asia, I examine medieval borderlands that witness passage, journey, abandonment along the region's most significant rivers, known in different epochs as the Oxus, then the Yarkun, thereafter the Amu Darya. Through the course of the invasions and within its critical role as a liminal contact zone between two distinct cultural realms, the Arab versus the Persian, the Amu Darya served as a selectively permeable border boundary condition for large Arab armies moving across Khorasan. These armed contingents, frequently affiliated tribesmen, whom I shall describe later in some detail, forded the river at two crossing points along its length. Both crossing points retained this significant role through time, continuing to connect the desert to the steppe. In revisiting these crossing points, I therefore lend voice to the river's tumultuous history and to the seemingly inconsequential cultural landscape on both its banks, reformulating its role as the only geographic truism in Eurasia, and in marked contrast to the region's arbitrarily drawn, so with era state boundaries. While extending upon the scholarship in the fields of Islamic urban studies, my project also positioned itself in specific ways. First and foremost, given that the scholarship serves as a basis for my work, my own ways of seeing and mapping are a radical shift given my comparative macro and analytical view of ancient and medieval imprints of cities spread across eastern Iran and Central Asia. No mappings of this kind have ever been attempted, especially for sites that hold little strategic significance. This has included all of the utilitarian structures that surround the largest urban centers, namely hinterland areas, hydraulic networks, defensive walls, bulwarks, and the plethora of ruins. Secondly, many of my imageries and described journeys move beyond the biases of earlier scholars in the field who have predominantly examined archaeological assessments of ancient settlements in the Persian plateau as sites of ancient cults and largely via their superlative monuments, artifacts, and inscriptions. In contrast, my work serves as an early, if not decidedly, self-conscious recognition that if indeed the traditions of Persian urbanism should be seriously assessed, these must be viewed within the broader framework of networked urbanism. And I have a slide. It's deliberately dark. In this view of so-called mat urbanism, multiple interconnected large and small cities occupied the landscape in the region of ancient and medieval Persia, creating continuously urbanized region. No longer is the isolated site merely valuable to examine, therefore, rather its merit is arguably greater when viewed in the context of the urbanized region. The third and perhaps most critical quality of my work is the reassessment of the archive itself and what it constitutes, and I shall speak about this later in the presentation. Within the gamut of my work, while the archive constitutes finite repositories, including texts, documents, and maps, all this exists alongside the infinite repository of the landscape or terrain that awaits a deliberate remapping, reinterpretation, and historiographic reassemblage to unpack its stories. While my documentations would possibly befit a standard archaeological survey, some of my redrawings are done to leverage an abstraction wherein connections to site and context are tantalizingly revealed. So too are my attempts to employ the background, foreground, and middle ground in my photographic frames as ways to capture the information within the limits of a single visual view. Now, at the point when I began to do this research, I became really interested in an aerial mapper from the 1940s, from the 1930s and 40s. His fabulous repository is actually very close to Milwaukee. It sits in the Oriental Institute in Chicago, and he is Eric Schmidt. I'm actually writing an article on Eric Schmidt as we speak in the Persian Studies Journal. And what I became interested with Eric Schmidt, and because some of the pictures from his fabulous book, Flights Over the Cities of Iran, where he actually goes in a small plane and is able to see the imprints of cities in the sands of time. Now, why I became interested in Eric Schmidt was because he was, in fact, the first archaeologist to start to document civilization from the sky. And when he documented this civilization, he did not just look at the cities that were archaeological sites, but the interconnections between these cities. Now, what I also discovered in his work was the fact that there was an obsession with the macro and the micro views. So he was looking at things in great detail, but at the same time, he was also trying to zoom out and establish connections between the smaller, more important objects, vis-a-vis the connections to the rest of the site. So these are some of the macro views, and this is in eastern Iran, and you can begin to see the grids of cities that have disappeared long back in time. Or some of the macro views here, which are about the way in which the mounds of a particular village are sitting in connection with farmland, the hinterland that surrounds the entire landscape. Or this one, which is a micro view of the city of Sumach, which is actually a square city which once had walls around it, and which has now in some ways disintegrated to a large extent, and farmland is almost touching the outer perimeters of the city. Or things that are barely perceptible. And this is where I think Eric Schmidt was to be much admired, and no one took him seriously at that time because the Second World War came around. So his handsome volume that he produced, his beautiful publication that was brought out by the Oriental Institute, only 10,000 copies were printed. And within the United States, only 70 repositories owned a copy. And the rest of them are all either sitting at a collector's shop or they are outside the United States. Today, this particular volume is worth about $4,000, this very large book, which is beautifully produced and which has all of these very nice pictures. And of course, the pictures are only a handful from the complete repository that Schmidt actually produced. Now, why I was actually also interested in Schmidt was that he was not only photographing, but in a way quite different from an archaeologist, he was also analyzing. So he actually took the aerial photograph of this particular site, and he actually has drawn these red lines that describe what he interprets in terms of what the site is saying. Now, I put a map of the Silk Road here just to situate you where we are talking about in the sense of this particular river. So this is India, and this is Samarkand, also called as Marakanda, and that's Bukhara. So you have to understand that this river is actually cutting right through the heart of Central Asia. So that's the Aral Sea. But once upon a time, there was a story that this river actually also connected to the Caspian Sea, and I will talk about that in a few minutes. How do physical borders and boundaries delineate the nature of cultural interactions and determine the development of historical time and place? What are the kinds of spaces created alongside borders that promote inclusive permeability versus boundaries that generate exclusive separation? So in some ways, my conversation with you has shifted from methodology to ways of looking at geography. And when I look at geography, I don't look at the river as a river. I don't look at the river as a water body. I look at it almost as a threshold of some sort that separates one cultural realm from another. Critical biographies of borderlands, the conditions created by these borders and boundaries, are evocative biographies of no places and the people who no longer live there. Yet these biographies are seldom recorded in scholarly writings, even though the passage of history through these spatial edges frequently leaves behind a rich palimpsest of cultural records. Extending upon Kevin Lynch's emphasis on edges and Richard Sennett's fascinating distinction between boundaries that divide versus borders that serve as a setting of exchange, this research examines one such borderland condition on the legendary Silk Road, located on Central Asia's important Oxus River, now the Amu Darya. Combining a close reading of archival sources spread across repositories in the Russian Federation, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan with innovative fieldwork, it unravels how conflict, reconciliation, and interaction between the medieval Arab and Persian communities created hybrid urban forms alongside this geographically significant and politically critical divide. Now, I'm not probably the first one who actually talked about the river as a threshold. The river was always seen as a threshold, even in the Islamic times. In the Islamic world, the medieval Islamic world, had often conceptualized its place in the larger framework of humanity. And this is a map showing the medieval Islamic world and its borders. This is about the 10th century, and you can see that the eastern border extends all the way to a region known as Al-Mashriq. And you can begin to see the rivers, the two rivers, the Sil Darya and the Amu Darya. And then on the western side, the limits of the Islamic world, they extend all the way to Al-Andalus, which is Spain. A similar kind of conceptualization was also done in the Persian world, and this is more, in some ways, more teleological than geographical. And this is based more on kishwars, or the way in which you could actually have divisions of the world which are all of equal size, and there are six that surround the seventh. And this is from the 13th century. There was another a kind of subdivision of the Islamic world, conceptualization of borders and boundaries that was happening in the work of philosopher, historian, biographer, geographer Al-Muqaddasi, who was writing between 945 and 1005. And he actually divided the known world at that time into seven climates or klima, north of the equator, and these are the seven climates that he divided the world into. Now what Muqaddasi was also doing, which I will explain a little bit further, he was dividing the Islamic world into different fragments, which he called as iqlims, which were really portions that in some ways were controlled by a certain metropolises. And one of the iqlim was actually Al-Mashriq, which is Central Asia, which was in some ways represented by two metropolises, Nishapur and Samarkand. And this way of thinking about space, this way of thinking about geography, is in fact quite similar to central place theory in urban planning. And central place theory only came about in existence in about 1930, at the time when cities began to be extended. So in fact, Al-Muqaddasi's work was, it predates this kind of conceptualization of the world. One other person that I would like to talk about, and I'm extending on Al-Muqaddasi's work, is the way in which his conceptualization of hierarchical urban systems in the Islamic world. And here I have two maps showing Al-Muqaddasi's functional urban systems. And this will zoom in a couple of minutes. And if it's focused enough for you from where you're sitting, you will see Al-Mashriq all the way on the right side of the screen. And you have Nishapur and you have Iran Shahar. And then you have this particular map here again. And you see the Indian subcontinent. And here you see Central Asia, you see the Caspian Sea, and right here is the Aral Sea. Spurred by the success of the Ridda Wars following the death of Prophet Muhammad, the formidable Oxus was crossed by the Arab armies in the year 673 CE. The early raids were followed by sustained expeditions by 700 CE, finally culminating in decisive control and habitation of the region's urban centers by 750 CE. For the Arab armies, crossing the Oxus, or the Yarhun in Arabic, symbolized great glory, unchallenged access to the riches of the prosperous region of Mawarannahr, and subsequently an empire in Hindustan. However, beyond its significance as a geographical barrier, the Oxus had also long served as a distinct yet permeable cultural boundary, situated strategically at a global borderland separating Persia, more specifically Khorasan, and the region of Central Asia. It had always remained an inviolate in-between space, a veritable void between two distinct cultural realms. However, little happened on the Oxus itself, save for a series of nondescript, inconsequential towns of no special significance. In contrast to the many other important rivers in global history, the Oxus River or the Amu Darya did not create fecund settings for settled cultures along its immediate banks. No cities crowded its edges. Even agricultural practices relied largely on the deep irrigation canals or the karyas that ran roughly perpendicular to its flow. Instead, the river existed as a real frontier for human movements, a barrier that separated yet inherently connected the cultural realms. It served as a symbolic threshold to a sedentarized cultural condition for the migrant Arab armies. If the east-west span of more than 1,500 miles served as one conspicuous feature of this intimidating frontier, the selected points of its viable crossings only exaggerated its formidability. Not that it was impassable elsewhere, but rather that in historical terms, these crossing points served as cultural crucibles and definitive paths to the most important cities of the region. And here you can begin to see Merv and Bukhara, and you can see the city of Charjui, which is along the river, which is in fact the direction in which the Ridda armies actually came. They camped at Merv and then they crossed the river, and one portion of the armies veered westwards to go to the region of Khwarazm towards the Aral Sea. In this regard, especially important were the legendary cities of Samarkand, Bukhara, Penjikan, Merv, and Termez. Many of the urban centers served as destinations for the moving armies, while the others served as precursors to still larger expeditions. This research interrogates the process of the monumental Arab urban expansion, or the tamsil, that accompanied the diffusion of Islam following these invasions north and east of the Oxus River, a semi-porous border separating the armed Arab and non-Arab forces on the west from the Iranian, Turk, and Sogdian world on the east. It suggests that this tamsil, in its synthesis of mainstream Islamic building, city-building traditions with the nascent quasi-nomadic Sogdian urbanity, effectively transformed military encampments first into urban quarters and later into impressive cities. In extension, as agents of this unprecedented cultural encounter between two disparate worlds, the Arab armies intervened on the cities of Sogdiana, Bactria, and Khwarezm to create the most vital centers of urban life. Traditional cities in the Islamic world further west and south of Central Asia had a dense structure within an encircling wall, and eventually the residential areas were found to extend beyond the wall, only themselves to be eventually protected by another wall. However, in Central Asia, a unique and further development took place in the plans of its cities. Here, the main administrative functions and markets moved out into this outer residential area and abandoned the central core entirely. In the so-called suburban city model, which predates our notions of suburbia by more than 1,000 years, this outer area of the city, also called the Rabat, became the locus of political and commercial activity. In due course, the process repeated itself, the residential areas overflowing beyond the walls of the Rabat, only themselves to be surrounded by a third outer wall. So now, we've talked about these cities and how these cities changed. And when we were looking at these cities, when I was going through all these texts, the three texts that really came to the forefront was the one written by Al-Muqaddasi, the Ihsan al-Taqsim, the one written by Al-Tabari, who in his 36 volumes, called the Tariq al-Tabari, documents the process of the Arab invasions on Central Asia, and finally Anasir Narsaki, who is actually the chronicler of the city of Bukhara, who writes this text known as the Tariq al-Bukhara, in which he details out the spaces in the medieval city of Bukhara. This is the kind of information we got, thick information, lots of text, and we decided to separate it out into the ways in which you could quantify and qualify. There were certain parts of the text that talks about the qualities, certain talked about the shape, certain talked about the size, certain talked about the population, and so forth. So this is just a demonstration of what was done with the text. We categorized the text with, we connected all these qualities with these cities in this particular manner. And we had a number of cities in Central Asia, some of them we could not even put on the map because they had disappeared, but they were mentioned in the text. What was even quite interesting is that when we started looking at Al-Tabari's text, we began to realize that in his 36 volumes, out of the 36 volumes, there were about 14 volumes that deal with the invasions on Central Asia. And some of those texts are quite obscure because they don't really tell you about where the armies are going. They talk about the everyday events that the army is actually coming to terms with. So we decided to diagram those books in ways that would help us. So we classified that into origins and destinations. And we realized that the river was in some ways a way to talk about these journeys. So we have the land that is south and west of the river, and we have the land that is east and north of the river. And each of these colors, it actually represents one year in which the invasions happened. So we realized that there was a whole way in which we could make charts in terms of what city was the origin, what city was the destination. And these dots in some ways demonstrate how big or small the city really was in terms of being a center. We have also, at this particular point in time, correlated every city with the number of men who were housed in these cities. So we exactly know that at what particular point urbanization actually expanded in what particular part of Khorasan and Sogdiana. So while this happens, the Oxus borderland was significant in one additional way. Unlike early expeditions that had crossed the Oxus through the course of its history, the Arab forces never intended to return to their homelands. In the centuries following the invasions, they assimilated widely among the local population, settling permanently to expand the urban centers along the legendary Silk Road. In effect, not only did cities in the Mawar-e-Nahr differ from cities elsewhere in their morphologies, as I've already explained to you, but they also commanded a diverse set of sedentary, migrant, and migrating populations. By employing the trope of the Oxus River as a selectively permeable cultural divide that continually morphed between the avatars of barrier and boundary in the centuries following the Arab invasions, this research therefore proposes that examining this riverine condition would be critical towards understanding the genesis of these urban emporiums. Now, this particular chart that is going here, you actually realize the names of these cities next to the river, once again, south and west of the river, and north and east of the river. And you also realize that there are these very light lines that are going through, which are not immediately obvious when you see from there. But these are, in fact, in some ways showing you the distance from the river. What we discovered was that most of the important cities were never built near the river. They were built far away from the river. In fact, for about 100 miles on both sides of the river, it was almost like enemy domain. It was, in fact, fallow land. It was a place to be crossed, but it was not a place to live or to inhabit. So these are all the archaeological sites that have now been mapped. So essentially, the slightly fertile part of Turkmenistan, the more fertile part of Uzbekistan, the river in the center, the desert taking over. And the three most important cities for our work are the city of Marv, the city of Bukhara, and the city of Samarkand. And the crossing point between Marv and Bukhara being the city of Amur or Charjui, and I will talk about it later. And when you get to Khwarazm, the most important crossing center is Hazarasp, and later on Khojeli, which is what it's called today, which is near Urgench. All the sites plotted, and on the left you begin to see the river. All of these archaeological sites that we have taken from Al-Tabari's accounts. If you go to Turkmenistan today, you can actually go all the way from Memph to Bukhara, and you can hardly see these sites. In fact, the guide will actually push you on because they will not allow you to stop. And many of these sites are actually archaeological sites. They've never been mapped except with a GIS instrument. I don't know why this is fuzzy. And then on the eastern side, you realize that when you cross from Merv to Bukhara, you actually were able to also extend into Samarkand, and that was a completely different route. So the invasions happened in a way where most of the men came from Merv all the way to Bukhara, and then they came to Samarkand, and from there they moved further eastwards. So this is what the journey was like, and in fact, it's still like this. There are very few boats that ply on the Amu Darya River, and in fact, there are no pleasure cruises on this particular river. It's actually a very different river in that sense. It's very mercurial, it's very changing, but all the trips between one side and the other, even in the medieval times, were fraught with danger because the river was unpredictable. This is the nature of cities in this particular part of the world. Prior to the Arab invasions, you actually had something what urban historians call as a concentric city model, which is a city that grows in layers around the center. And essentially, this is the typical city in eastern Iran. At the time of the Arab invasions, there is another model, a prototype that is brought into this particular region, which some people call as the Amzar, which is the armed encampment. which is in fact an encampment that allows the Arab armies to stay in the field. It's organized with a particular hierarchy. And many of these armed Amzars actually added on to the existing cities of this particular region. Finally, the special aspect about the cities across the Amu Darya, which I've already spoken about, but graphically explained, and before that, the city that was there in eastern Iran prior to the Arab invasions was a city that was growing inwards, in other words, densification with time. In contrast, the city that began to grow after the Arab invasions was actually a suburban or a Rabat-based city, which was a city that began to grow outwards, adding layers along its circumference, actually creating a central void. And one of the typical examples of this particular city was the city of Merv, which had a foundation from the time of Alexander, and I will show you Merv in a little while, where the center of Merv is actually a foundation that is absolutely round. By about the 7th century, the center of the city was completely abandoned. It had actually become a watermelon plantation. Most of the population of the city had actually moved out into the suburbia. And we thought suburbia was a 20th century phenomenon. So you have the East Iranian city on the left. You have the Central Asian city on the right. The East Iranian city created by means of densification of the center. The Central Asian city created by the layers actually coming out, with the center being relatively denuded and becoming empty. In fact, there is the creation of these multiple areas of suburbia. Now, the next animation that I have while I talk about the river is an animation that will show you a little bit about mapping. One of the things that we experimented in this particular project was going through very large repositories of maps. And we realized that these repositories of maps did not always see eye to eye. They were done at different times. Some of them were done in the Islamic times. Some of them were done in the times of the Tsar. Some of them were done in the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries. And they were all done for different purposes. Some of them were irrigation maps. Some of them were maps in order to recreate the canal system of the Amu Darya. Still others were maps that were created in order to show how certain defensive bulwarks could be constructed in order to guard the lands of Central Asia from a possible invasion by the British, because you're after all talking about the area of the Great Game. So what we realized was that in order for these maps to be joined together and for information to be drawn out from these maps, we actually had to start cutting and pasting them, literally. We had to start twisting and turning them in order to create, number one, the entire river. Because for some strange reason, today in Central Asian history, today in Central Asian politics, the river does not really belong to one country, it belongs to many countries. Once upon a time, this river was, as I've said, the truism in Central Asia. So it actually was one large river. And in fact, for that reason, no country, no state has come to terms with documenting the river completely. So it was really important to document the river and to chart its course. One of the important things here was also to chart its course all the way to the Caspian Sea and to search for the depression that allowed this particular course to be seen. So once again, looking for information in maps that allowed this to be put forward. With respect to the connection of the Amu Darya to the Caspian Sea, in fact, that's not a figment of your imagination. It seems that there are accounts of it, historical accounts of it, till about the 13th century. After that, it seems that there was a huge dam which used to exist at Gurganj, which is current-day Urgench, which was demolished by the Mongols. And thereafter, the river entirely changed course to the north to fall into the depression now called as the Aral Sea. The other thing that we were interested in is the way in which this river had always been seen as mercurial and ever-changing. So this animation that I'm going to start here is sort of going to go hand in hand while I talk about the river further. So the region of Central Asia with the Amu Darya River, stretching about 1,500 miles from the northeast, from the northwest to the southeast, starting at Lake Zorkul in Afghanistan and going all the way across to the Aral Sea in Khwarazm. Moving away from discussions on urbanity, it is within this broad picture of radical change, radical and ethnic change, the decisive shift from nomadic to settled lifestyles that the Amu Darya or Oxus River must be reconsidered. The river border served as an astonishing natural feature within the otherwise relentlessly flat, semi-arid desert landscape of Central Asia. The writings of Al-Tabari describe that the Arab forces mainly approached it from the southwest, traveling across the bleak desert waste from the grand city of Merv, the launching base for their many expeditions. They crossed this geographical divide at the city of Charjui, ancient Amur, ingeniously employing pontoons, platforms, and boats. Today, Charjui remains one of four international crossing points connecting Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, all located within the Amu Darya, now transformed as modern Charzu for the Uzbeks and Turkmenabad for the Turkomans. It is within this landscape that the mighty Oxus as if appeared quite suddenly for the wary traveler, flowing between the Karakum to the west and the Kizilkum desert to the east, banked by low cliffs. There was little irrigation and even fewer settlements as the river carved and meandered its way through a peculiarly desolate and unpeopled landscape. The river itself, in its breadth and strength of current, seemed an alien invader in this terrain of few cities. While Charjui meant four canals, attesting to the traditional name of this province, Lebak, the name given to this particular part of the river implied literally the grand mouth of the Amu Darya and its division into four distinct canals in its upper course. In fact, like all large rivers and alluvial plains, the Amu Darya was prone to shifting its banks, so much so that not only had it moved and split, as at Lebak, it may have actually changed its course entirely. Ancient Greek travelers, medieval Arab and Persian historians, and Russian explorers who scoured the regions on the Tsar's patronage all described the Amu Darya as exceptionally mercurial. Several documented the possibility of the Amu Darya's connection to the Caspian as late as the early 13th century versus its current-day drainage into the Khwarazm watershed of the Aral Sea. Anyone who has read Twain's accounts of the Mississippi knows that the Mississippi of his day changed face year to year. Its banks constantly eroded, the river bottom shifted depth, and farms along the shore became islands without warning. Likewise, the Oxus's companion river that still lies further north and west, the Jakharates for the ancient Greeks, now the Sir Darya, used to shift its banks up to 100 yards sideways in the course of a single year. By the mid-1800s, Russian engineers had constructed Eurasia's first railway track across the deserts through which these twin rivers ran. While they did not even come near the Oxus for good reason, they did leave records about the unruly Sir Darya. Its vicinity, they said, quote, was filled with a constant noise and the tumult of crashes as pieces of the bank slid into the water, end quote. So you begin to see the two crossing points here, the crossing of Charjui, which connects Merv and Bukhara. Charjui was earlier called Amul, and the crossing of Khojel.
Was the railroad you referred to, was that the part of the Trans-Siberian?
It was. It was the beginning of the Trans-Siberian.
Right.
Excuse me, that's a mistake. It was the Trans-Caspian Railway.
Yes.
From Siberia runs about 500 miles
further north.
But the tracks are now used for the Trans-Siberian.
No. It's a different railway.
Okay. So this is the Khojeli crossing. And this set of slides shows you the Caspian Sea connection, which is brought out by means of maps. So the bent of the oxus was similarly variable. Looking through Islamic and Russian documents, one finds that it had a complicated lower course. Until at least the early medieval times, corresponding with the Arab invasions on Central Asia, it was dammed by two very large engineering marvels, described by Al-Muqaddisi in 985 CE as built of wood, stonework, and adobe, resembling wickerwork. The first of these structures lay near Amul, which is our first crossing point, or Charjui, today's Charjui, the historical crossing point across the river. The other was at Gurganj, today's Urganj, where the river bifurcated into two distinct beds, one running westwards towards the Caspian via the Surikamish Depression, the other fork turning northwards to later become the Aral Sea watershed. Given its dramatic sectional disparities in depth and width, the Oxus was never a particularly navigable river for any substantial distance along its banks, or one that logically connected the urban emporiums as described along its length in Al-Tabari's accounts. Rather, it was characterized by quick, silent journeys on flat-bottomed kikes from side to side, the ominous peril writ large on the faces of those in passage. For all other purposes, men and goods moved in large quantities along across the inhospitable desert. So to talk about migration, crossing, and contestation. How an encounter between two culturally removed worlds, one characterized by its accretive urban conurbations of propinquity, the other relishing detached encampments in suburbia, exaggerated by the borderland condition of the Oxus River, affect the making of these cities in Central Asia? How did the Oxus contact zone, divisive locally as it was internationally, acknowledge the multiplicity of urban experiences and the agency of multiple actors? Why did the Oxus or the Yehun remain, and still does, as the infamous and much depleted Amu Darya, a global border determining the geopolitics of Central Asia? Finally, would it be topical to consider the sliver of a riverine east-west divide between Khorasan and Central Asia, often positioned within the convenient space-time continuum of early medieval Islamic history, as a cultural condenser of unprecedented historical significance? The Oxus Borderland Project, in its emphasis on journey, passage, interaction, and the spaces produced, yes, critical in its reconstruction of the hybrid nature of these cities, effectively disentangles the issues of conflict, reconciliation, and interaction writ large in the historicity of the urban and borderland spaces, this one located in the epicenter of the contentious geopolitics of the Stans in Central Asia. For the advancing Arab and significantly non-Arab forces, the region of Khorasan with the Oxus River forming its northeastern edge was a frontier land, an active bulwark against the enemies of Islam, whether Iranians or Turks. While the word frontier still remains the best English term to describe this contentious riverine boundary condition, the Arabic sources employ a multitude of terms to describe the same, including thagra, plural thugr, had, nib, and awasim as a boundary between territories. In this case, one that separated the Dar al-Islam from the Dar al-Harb. Yet, given that the river was perceived as a boundary, it seems accessible in certain ways. On these lines, the Arab sources especially praise the fighting talents and the valor of the Khorasanites from this region of the Dar al-Harb, emphasizing that they were, quote, a shield for the Muslims against the Turks, end quote, the latter being, quote, the bravest, the toughest, and the most persistent of all enemies, end quote, which the Muslims had ever encountered. The incessant military activity on the Khorasanite front obliged the Muslim warriors to maintain a perpetual state of alertness and remain in the fields for long periods of time. The effect of this perpetual alertness on the social morale of the troops may have also compelled the virtual replication of inter-tribal groupings, or ahmas, from Basra in Iraq to be maintained in the region of Khorasan. It also had an effect on numbers. Conservatively, scholars have assumed that 47,000 Arab warriors would have represented the total fighting force in the region of Khorasan. Given this number, Wellhausen estimates that the total migrant and Arab population in the whole of Khorasan could not have exceeded 200,000. And this is not a small figure, by the way, of a migrant population. This population, and in particular its non-combatant majority, established permanent settlements in the towns and the villages of Khorasan. The Kai Alan clan settled in the western district of Khorasan, in particular Nishapur and its environs, while the Taming tribe in the district of Tus. Similarly, the Azdites settled down mainly in the villages surrounding the capital city of Melv. Even so, the Arab tribesmen were dispersed among the local population in many settlements or villages surrounding the urban centers. Dispersion in villages also meant that the Arab minority was assimilated with local Iranian, Turk or Sogdian majority, so much so that preoccupation with Asabiya or tribal identity in the Umayyad period is followed by disintegration of the Arab tribal structure and replaced by local village forms of organization by 700. The outward expression of this change appears in Al-Hamadani's account, which says that the Khorasanites were Ansabuhum al-Qura. In other words, their pedigree was traced back merely to their villages. Finally, the Arab Mukhatila performed the double function in Khorasan and subsequently Sogdiana. They fought against the enemies of Islam who surrounded them, and also in the intervals fought against themselves in the war of hierarchical supremacy. Interestingly, therefore, while permanent settlements were specifically excluded from the combat area, both sides established fortresses or trenches to launch the operations. So these maps that I'm showing you here are 120-something maps that we acquired from a declassified Soviet military archives from the 1940s, which document the entire river and the crossings of the river. Of course, there were more maps, but we could only afford to buy a certain number. I'm always looking for ways to buy the rest. And we actually, what we did with these maps, which are at 1 to 50,000 scale, with all the details of the contour, and by the way, this is unspoiled landscape at this particular point in time. It still is, because it's no man's land. We have constructed three-dimensional models, which I will show you in a few minutes. So this is the river all the way through, and that's the crossing.
Who did you buy them from?
There was a map company in the they contacted someone in the Soviet Union, and we got a bargain. So here we are going to the origins of the Amu Darya, the Lake Zorkul, and the way the river actually originates there and goes all the way down to what then actually becomes a river that goes through the heart of Central Asia. And this is an animation that will play itself, and I will talk a little bit about it because I would like you to enjoy the images. So far I've spoken quite a bit, and then I will get back to my paper after the animation. So following the Amu Darya, from origin to destination, from the Lake Zorkul to the Aral Sea. So going on its upper course and getting to about the middle of the river, where you begin to see Uzbekistan on this side and Turkmenistan on the other side. And you actually begin to see the beginnings of the oases, the Bukharan oases on the right, and then the Melv oases on the left. And you will see the Melv oases in a few minutes. You can see the beginning of the Melv oases. That is Charjui. Many of these water bodies have been artificially created over the last several decades. Going further up the river to its lower course, we have still not come to terms with the second crossing point, which is in Khwarazm, because this one is taking us that long, but we hope that once we get this done really well, we will actually be able to say that given more resources, we can do the second one, but we really know the location of it. But what we've done, we've taken all these maps, we've combined them together, we've made one very large document. So this is the Aral Sea Delta. It's also called the Amu Delta. Of course, the Aral Sea is
dry.
It's pretty dry. And then the camera will come around and look at the river again.
the large white area is salt concentration?
They're salt concentration, yes. And now, so this is a view from the northwest to the southeast. And on the left of you, you see Bukharan, the Bukharan oasis, and further out to the left is Samarkand, and then on the right side is Marv. Now you're getting close to the river. I'm showing you the extent of detail that we have of this landscape in the maps that we received. And what we've done, we've taken this and we've stitched it with the three-dimensional rendering of the river, because we somehow want to communicate the primordial nature of this landscape, because that's where I feel that we can talk about the landscape as it is without being contaminated by historical development. What did the landscape see? Zooming out again.
So this is all based on those Soviet military maps?
This is based on the Soviet military maps. So now we'll zoom on the river to the crossing point, the Charjui crossing. This is the place where we have two bridges, a rail bridge and a pontoon bridge. This is also called Pristan Farab. So this is the wire freight model. That is rendered using Revit and Rhino. That's the map from where it came. That's a sectional profile. As an architect, you're always interested in the section, because in some ways, the section is created by the accumulations of time. So the sectional profile, because we also had information on the depth of the riverbed from all the Russian surveys. So we have very extensive surveys that actually talk about the way the depth is worked out. And what's actually quite spectacular is in this otherwise relatively flat landscape, the river and the topography along the river is the only dramatic part of this journey. So they must have journeyed across this very dry landscape in Turkmenistan, and I will show you that in a few minutes. And then they found the river, they crossed it, and they went to the very fertile landscape to the north and to the east. So that is the landscape on the left, which is the city of Merv, which is right now schematic in this particular animation. And that is the city of Bukhara. This is what the crossing looks like. This is what Labakh looks like today, where the river actually splits up into four streams of some kind. Now, I've documented this river quite intensively. I've actually taken pictures of the landscape, and some of these landscapes are quite spectacular. One would think that in a desert landscape, you would not find color. You would not find contrast and tonality. But these are some of the pictures of the river that I was able to capture with guards standing along the river, because it's actually no man's land. It's actually the border zone between Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. We are, in fact, incorporating this particular information into our animations as we speak. I also saw some archaeological remnants. This is actually Chilpik Kala. This is actually a Dakhma, Tower of Silence, all the way from the 2nd century. And then there are places where the desert sands combine together. You can actually see the black sands and the red sands come together. Close to the river, you have landscape like this where, in fact, this lends credibility to my claim that it's the only place where the excitement of seeing the river lies. Now we are going to the city of Merv, and of course, I will not show you Merv in great detail. We are rendering it as we speak right now, but Merv is quite spectacular. It is a conurbation of many cities that have grown one after the other, and of course, it has the remains of these fabulous mud walls from across time. And many of these developments are walled. And in fact, this oasis was a fairly guarded oasis which moved progressively westwards as the course of the Murghab River gradually changed over time. Now, the journey from Merv to Bukhara is what we are most interested in. So leaving Merv behind, because Merv for the Arab armies was more like an in-between destination. And then all the armies prepared to go across the river all the way to Bukhara. So leaving Merv behind, what is it to leave Merv behind? It would have been the vestiges of these walls that were already fading away, vestiges of these large forts that were falling into disrepair, and the kind of view that the Arab armies would have seen would have been as follows. And we've actually tried to recreate that view by putting all the maps together that document the crossing. So this particular crossing where Bukhara is all the way above you, and this is the crossing point of the river. This is how the landscape would have been seen once upon a time when there was very little geological change that had happened on both sides of the river. So they would have probably waited here a few days. In fact, the accounts talk about sort of camping overnight and then making preparations to cross the river. Finally, they would have reached the city of Bukhara that lay to the north. And now I'll take you to Bukhara. But before that, the river crossing as it exists today. This is Farah Pristan, and the rail bridge is on the left side, the pontoon bridge is on the right side. And Bukhara lies about 120 miles to the northeast. This is again the crossing. This is from one of the Soviet maps.
These are 1 to 50,000?
Yes.
Great.
So we're moving to the Bukhara Oasis.
120 meters. 120 meters. 500.
So we go to the core of the city, which you see in that particular view here. This is how it looks today on Google Maps. But we will zoom in. But before that, the old walls of Bukhara, which still lie in the oasis far, far outside, and they are far away from tourist traps. Tourists don't go there anymore, but they are quite interesting because they somehow enclose the entire oasis together. So the plan of the city, the Google image of the city, and then zooming into the very center, which is actually the oldest part of the city.
When you said the plan of the city, whose plan at what time?
This particular plan is from the Russian times.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're zooming into the citadel area, which is much derelict and demolished, but we have recreated the entire citadel. Today, the citadel of Bukhara can be visited, but there are only a few structures that are preserved. Everything else is in ruins. So I have a rather long conclusion, and maybe if you indulge, if I can indulge you in reading this out. In conclusion, the story of the Oxus, the Jaihun, or the Amudarya, and in particular its intertwined tryst with the destinies of the migrating communities, the Arabs and the Persians, should be viewed within the purview of inter-Asian connections and context. In this sense, the Eurasian heartland remains a region yet reconciling to its palimpsest of past and recent histories. This so-called enemy terrain was a surprising cultural condenser of negotiation, mediation, and cross-cultural, ethnic, trans-civilizational sharing, at least for the multitude of Eurasian nomadic groups who crossed the same river for many centuries prior to the 1700s. Complex disruptions impacted the historical memory of migration and geography with the extension of Russian control over Eurasia beginning in the 1870s, initiated by the Bolsheviks. Eurasia's internal borders were arbitrarily delineated by Soviet bureaucrats in Moscow in the early 1920s. Lenin, in his letter to the communists of Turkestan, asked them to investigate how many states Central Asia ought to have and what these should be named. While the idea of sovereign and independent ethnic-based states was largely alien and exotic for the locals, even the conception of a divided Turkestan was unthinkable. Vasily Bartold, a well-known Central Asian scholar, in the 1920s, warned that that Central Asia had no historic experience on the paradigm of an ethnic state, and it would be a grave error to divide the region along ethnic lines, specifically via superficial borders that leverage the apparent divisiveness of geographical separators, such as the Oxus River, which ran through the heart of Central Asia. Bartold also recognized that the term borders and boundaries in Eurasia's uniquely nomadic condition were but anomalies, and given the Amudarya's role as a cultural unifier, should be replaced with the term territory. For the nomad, sporadic and non-sporadic movements caused nomadic territory to become their ownership, inviolable from other tribes or sedentary populations via the territorial recognition of geography. Nevertheless, little of this sentiment was seriously entertained when the Turkestan Autonomous Soviet Socialist Republic gradually progressed towards its current borders and communication infrastructure based on a strong belief in the inseparable union of 15 Soviet republics. It was assumed that their eternal interdependence, especially with the republics of Central Asia, would form a natural bond owing to their historical and geographic proximities. As a result, numerous segments of the borders, in some cases disputed, were never delimited nor formally demarcated. This process still remains incomplete, and while several land borders have now become impregnable, the formidable Oxus and the medieval Amudarya have gradually become a convenient buffer zone that separates the now relatively fertile Uzbek steppes from the desolate, unbroken expanse of the Turkoman Desert. John Prescott's monumental studies of boundaries explains, quote, buffer states have been constructed on frontiers when two strong neighbors decide to reduce the possibility of conflict between them, end quote. I ask, if then indeed the Central Asian nations in mention, and I'm talking about Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, which are in some ways fighting to keep the river as the border, versus the opposite attitude where we would have thought that they would try to come together by using the river as a liminal zone that allowed them to interconnect. I ask if then indeed the Central Asian nations in mention fall into this particular category. Do they indeed risk imminent conflict? If not, should boundary or boundedness be now restated under the rubric of territoriality to allow this historical riverine demarcation to re-emerge from the shadows as Eurasia's historical lifeline? In fact, even today, Uzbeks can go to Turkmenistan, and they have special provisions in their passports that allow them to go there twice a month. And at festival times, at Nowruz time, they can go there, I think, four times in a month or something. It's a crazy system. A final observation has to do with the archive itself. As mentioned earlier, three main textual sources have been employed towards the study, besides several maps and surveys. The first is the work of geographical al-Muqaddisi, his work, the Ehsan al-Taqsim. The second is al-Tabari's impressive Tariq al-Rusul wa'al-Mulk, or Tariq al-Tabari. The third is al-Narsaki's Tariq al-Bukhara, the history of Mawar-e-Nehr's most prosperous city. If the Bradalian or the global view of the medieval Dar al-Islam and its diverse regions was one end of this intellectual spectrum for al-Muqaddisi, it was fittingly extended by al-Tabari's engaging travelogue documenting passage and journey for the Arab hordes in search of urban destinations, finally culminating in thick descriptions of place and time as encapsulated within the Bukharan urbanscape recreated by al-Narsaki. In effect, if studies on Near Eastern and Central Asian past have to come to terms with the present and future, and the true nature of Persianate civitas has to be eventually revealed as a unique phenomena, it is timely that we engage these medieval voices in remapping its urbanities. But beyond these sources, some of which have been known to Islamic urban historians already, it is the Oxus landscape itself, including the river's Mercurial floodplain, that has served as my biggest repository in the field. In fact, I've often asked myself if I have indeed exhausted this particular source or has examined aspects beyond its potomology. I introduced the word in the beginning. How do such past landscapes preserve the palimpsest of public memory? Dolores Hayden, the architectural historian, asked this question when interrogating urban landscapes, but I believe it would be just as relevant for a landscape site removed or in proximity to cities or places, natural settings or conditions. And in this particular case, where a variety of resources have been and continue to be found, shared, squandered, and jealously guarded. I'm talking here about water. Because today on the Amu Darya, you have 60 plus dams that divvy up the water and reduce the flow of the river to about 30% of what it was once upon a time. However, given that the borderlands such as the Oxus are also sites of abandonment, as I've tried to show to you, this remains a challenging task. So I have just two images more. One of them is this one, which is my way of saying that the Oxus River has changed from the pristine landscape to a landscape that has now become that. And then probably the most pressing issues that we now face in this kind of landscape, which are the issues of water and water sharing. And particularly this map here, which shows you the flow of the Amu Darya as it gets received from the mountains of Tajikistan and Afghanistan, and how it gets divided into all of these canals that the Soviets actually built during their legacy. Which is why almost no water reaches the Aral Sea. But that's another story. Thank you.
Join me. My reaction is wow. We have about 10 minutes for questions. And again, for those of you who came late, we're going off to the terrace for a bit, and I have many questions.
I was going to say that isn't there a similar problem, I think, on the Euphrates and even the Nile as far as water being diverted by countries upstream?
Absolutely. There is. It's just that, the Euphrates is in some ways troubled territory. Mm-hmm. I mean, we still have to come to terms with what is the Euphrates and, you know, what it was and how traumatic the experience of change has been for it. Mm-hmm. The Nile is actually a very good way of comparing the Amu Darya, except that I'm not 100% sure. I did a little bit of early research on the Nile, and I realized that it did not have the kinds of migrant groups that were crossing the river from one side to the other. Mm-hmm. They were always building on either side.
Right.
And there is also a tranquility about the Nile that the Amu Darya does not have. I mean, those barges down the Nile, or the Hollywood films that talk about passages down the Nile that are there. And also, the Nile, if you look at early history, Egyptian history, it's always looked at, it's always perceived as a permanence, which is why the pharaohs always put their pyramids on both sides. They were trying to make permanent mountains in a landscape that they thought was etched in time. Mm-hmm.